I'd like to start with your take on trends as the vaccine rollout continues to ramp up. COVID metrics continue their slow but steady, sometimes taking a pause, downward trend.
Hospitalizations are finally kind of like under 1,000 steadily. We only had 100 new hospital admissions yesterday across the state, which, you know, it's like one per county if you want to think about it, which is pretty good. We're down to about 250 people in the ICU, and we're getting down to about where we were in like October. And if we could get down to about where we were in like August, we could be a long way toward conquering this. The thing that still gives me pause are those variants. I've sat through a couple of webinars about variants this week, and the takeaway is this: people need to be vaccinated fast. You will have less of an opportunity to develop variants if people aren't getting sick from COVID. And then you will have fewer people who are susceptible to COVID when it is circulating. I think what we're going to end up seeing is these pockets of disease around the state, because there might be, say, a community where sort of the zeitgeist is like, I don't want to take the vaccine for whatever reason, whether it be political or there were, you know, science skepticism, or they're worried about something. But I think we'll end up seeing outbreaks, like smaller outbreaks there. It's going to take a long time for this to completely diminish. And, you know, those could be the kinds of place where, like, if the dominant variant circulating is, say, the British variant, which they found was more infectious, that could be a problem. So, and the CDC is thinking that, you know, sometime in the next month that that could be the dominant variant circulating in the U.S. There's also this concerning variant that's been reported coming from California. And then if you want to just scare the bejesus out of yourself, like, just go and read about what's happening in Brazil. This P1 variant in Brazil, it seems like, is able to infect people who've already had COVID.
Seriously, we need a show on variants. But I'm going to switch gears here before we run out of time. The NC Health News team has been shining the light on disparities in healthcare during the pandemic. And this week, you have an article doing that, focusing on people with disabilities. I didn't know this. Every state devised protocols for allocating scarce resources, basically who gets that last ventilator during the pandemic. And disability advocates say North Carolina's protocol fell short.
Well, early in the pandemic, they had to come up with these protocols. Everyone did. All these states did. They sort of convened panels and came up with protocols. And some states sort of had them in the drawer and rolled them out. And other states, you know, sort of devised them. And that was what we did. There was a meeting. It was convened by the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. It was a big phone call. Advocates tell me that, you know, there were like 45 people on the call, and it had like someone from the hospital association, someone from the medical society, someone from the Institute of Medicine, you know, ethicists, disability advocates, aging advocates. I mean, you name it, like all kinds of people who had an interest in all of this, you know, physicians, folks from the state, they were all on this call, and they're sort of thinking about, like, how are we going to be distributing stuff if this horrible time comes where we're going to have to essentially ration care? Like, how do you go about doing it? And the protocol that they promulgated, that, you know, there's a scoring system, and you use this SOFA score, you know, to like give people, it's a sequential organ failure assessment, like how many people, you know, their organs are failing. But one of the parts of it, which the disability advocates were like, whoa, was that it gave doctors permission to basically say, well, this is somebody who's likely not going to live a long time, so we can prioritize somebody else over this person who's not going to live a long time. And that could be because they were old, or that could be because they had a disability, a chronic disability. And what the disability advocates made really clear was that, you know, for many people with disabilities, their ICD-9 code, their diagnosis code, makes it look like, you know, they're kind of on death's doorstep, right? But the reality is that it's very hard to anticipate mortality, anticipate survivability. And that there has been a preponderance, and we're seeing this, you know, this is the year where everybody is realizing all the sort of implicit bias that we carry around with us. And I know it from my own practice, right? That part of the implicit bias for healthcare personnel is kind of you're in the clinic all the time. All you see is sick people. And you think, I wouldn't want to live like that. And what you don't see, and what I eventually was able to see because I worked in the disability movement for a couple of years, was that people with disabilities have pretty good lives. And they like their lives. And they would not have wanted a healthcare provider to kind of go, well, you know what, your life's going to suck, so we're not going to be so aggressive in treating you. So this is kind of like the thing that's percolating below the surface. We promulgated these guidelines that would allow for, you know, medical personnel to say, you know, this person doesn't have great long-term survivability, so we can downcode them in our calculations. We were not the only state that came to that conclusion. And what happened is that the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, they have this Office of Civil Rights, and the OCR at the federal DHHS dinged a bunch of other states and said, no, we cannot use long-term survivability as a measurement. That's not okay. It's inherently discriminatory.
So I don't want to give it all away, but bottom line, it took some alarm bell ringing by disability advocates to get a protocol change from that one-size-fits-all assessment, which was not equitable, to a more individualized one for rationing care.
We promulgated these new standards that have now been published and are the state's official policy. You know, and the disability advocates calling them, and I was like, well, you know, this is really important for, you know, like, what does it matter now? Like, we're past the crisis point. And they were like, oh, we're not out of the woods. Right? You know, like, what if a variant comes back and we have a resurgence? What if we have a bad flu pandemic? Like, we've seen that we haven't really done so great in this pandemic. So there is a fair amount of worry still in the disability community and the aging community that, you know, these attitudes are still out there and that they are vulnerable. And so having these standards promulgated and disseminated across the state creates a standard that someone with a disability and or their family member can say, look, this is the criteria you need to make. It's a complicated story. Like, it was not something that lended itself to, you know, a quick little 1500 word thing. It's a complicated topic, and it's tied up in all the things we've been talking about this year: discrimination in healthcare and disparities and who gets it and access to care. Like, it's all tied up in this whole issue. I was talking to someone this morning. She said, you know, this past year, we turned over that rock and we're looking at what's underneath that rock, and it's not pretty.